This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
You watch out for your interests. You watch out and you make calculations. What makes you think that David Rockefeller doesn't? What makes you think that the people at the top don't do it? And what makes you think they don't collude and organize?
Michael Parenti on so-called conspiracy theory.
The war on drugs is mostly a phony war, I would argue. It's a cover for imperialism, and it's a cover for the CIA's own drug dealing. It's also a cover for the war against political dissidents in various countries.
Michael Parenti on imperialism, drugs, and social control. The link between U.S. intervention and the CIA's use of drugs abroad and at home. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Michael Parenti, a giant on the American left, who influenced generations of activists, scholars, and ordinary Americans, died on January 24. He was 92 years old. Michael grew up in an Italian working-class family in New York City. He worked for several years after graduating from high school, then returned to school, earning a bachelor's degree at the City College of New York, a master's degree at Brown University, and a PhD in political science at Yale. While teaching at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, he joined a protest against the Kent State killings and the Vietnam War, during which state troopers clubbed him in the head and threw him in jail for 2 days. A prosecutor then charged him with disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and aggravated battery of a state trooper. Shortly after being released, on bond, he started a new job at the University of Vermont, but the following month he was convicted and released on 2 years parole. As a consequence, he was never able to secure a tenure-track teaching job, but he managed to make a living speaking and writing, producing more than 20 books, beginning with Democracy for the Few. Today we're playing two clips of his many talks. The first is his analysis of the conspiracy theory aspersion used to dismiss critiques of elite machinations.
Conspiracy theory is a term that's used whenever anybody ascribes conscious intent to people with power. So I can say to you that school teachers are concerned about their salaries and they're organizing and they're threatening a strike and they're pressuring. I can say to you that farmers are doing this and looking for subsidies and facing certain policies. But the minute I say to you that the very people at the top, the plutocracy, the very rich and powerful, the ones who own most of America, that they are consciously pursuing power and wealth, someone will come along and say, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? Or they'll say, oh, you're cynical or you're paranoid. Their view is that stuff just happens. Things just happen, unintended consequences, or our leaders are stupid, and they're jerks, or they're confused, and they don't know any better. And of course, the critic knows much better than everybody else. People who operate in this world operate with intent. There's no such thing as imperialism without imperialists. There's no such thing as capitalism without capitalists. There's no such thing as rulers who are somnambulists who walk around in their sleep. You watch out for your interests. You watch out and you make calculations. What makes you think that David Rockefeller doesn't? What makes you think that the people at the top don't do it? And what makes you think they don't collude and organize? Or what do you think? You have a group of people who sit around in a room and they plan this? And I always say, oh no, God, they don't sit around in a room. They meet on carousels and they go up and down merry-go-rounds, or they meet skydiving and they hold hands and they argue. Of course they sit in rooms. Where the hell else are they going to meet?
That was Michael Parenti on conspiracy theory.
Third world is not poor. You don't go to poor countries to make money. There are very few poor countries in this world. Most countries are rich. The Philippines are rich. Brazil is rich. Mexico is rich. Chile is rich. Only the people are poor. But there's billions to be made there, to be carved out and be taken. There's been billions for 400 years. The capitalist European and North American powers have carved out and taken the timber, the flax, the hemp, the cocoa, the rum, the tin, the copper, the iron, the rubber, the bauxite, the slaves, and the cheap labor. They have taken out of these countries. These countries are not underdeveloped, they're overexploited.
That was Anatiju Hordato, Kaluga Omenta. Now, we'll hear an excerpt of Michael's speech, Imperialism, Drugs, and Social Control, the link between U.S. intervention and the CIA's use of drugs abroad and at home. It was recorded in Boulder, Colorado on November 4, 1990, but could hardly be more relevant today, as Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro sits in a U.S. prison awaiting trial on preposterous charges that he heads an international drug trafficking ring.
The problem you have about talking about imperialism is that it's not accepted as a legitimate word by the major media, by our political leaders, by most of our mainstream academics. That is, they do not believe that imperialism, which has been and still is the most powerful force in the history of this world, in shaping the map of this world, they do not believe that it exists. If you say 19th century British imperialism, they'll say, oh, yes. Yeah. Or if you say Soviet imperialism, they'll say, oh, yes. But if you say US imperialism or Western imperialism, they'll say, you're being ideological, aren't you? What are you talking about? Oh, do you have a conspiracy theory? Imperialism, what they talk about in academia, you can't talk about imperialism. You cannot write your master's thesis or your PhD. If you say, if you go to your advisor and say, I want to do something on Western imperialism in Central America. And they say, you know, we don't like to do ideological things. You have to do scientific, empirical stuff, and that's not a real subject. So you say, well, can I do something on development theory and dependency theory? Oh, yeah, you could do that. So you call it development theory. But if you start talking about the realities of imperialism when you write that, they'll say, well, it seems to me you're being ideological again, not realizing how ideological they are in rejecting the terrible realities of what's going on in the world. Imperialism is when the ruling elites, the dominant interests of one country, control the land, the labor, the resources, the technology, the markets, and the wealth, the financial structure of another country, to the detriment of the ordinary people in the other country, and often to great cost to the people in the metropolitan country, in the imperialist country too. In other words, we aren't the benefits of U.S. imperialism in Central America. We help pay a lot of the overhead costs. We pay high taxes so they can have their global military machine to keep control of everything. We pay, in terms of the high taxes, to pay for that global military machine which controls, which is set up. You know, it really costs a lot of money to have 14 aircraft carrier units. I mean, you don't get just an aircraft carrier. When you send out an aircraft carrier, you have to have destroyers and cruisers and all sorts of surveillance planes and protected. It's a whole force. 14 aircraft carrier forces. 300 major military bases all around the world. We pay that. When you're worried about scholarships or you're not getting it or high taxes or this, that, you got to understand that's where that money's going. And you're paying. You pay palpably. A lot of you I know have already worked and earned your first paycheck. Do you remember that sensation when you got that first paycheck and you looked at it and you said, there must be some mistake? And you said, No, there's no mistake. Here's the rest over here. We took off for this, for this, for that. We took off for the cruise missiles, for the new tactical air-to-surface missiles. We took off for the B-1 bomber and the B-2 bomber and all that. But we call it federal taxes, though. Well, that's what you're paying for, and that's coming palpably right out of the lives of our people. When we don't have money for roads and we don't have money for hospitals, when we have to cut rehabilitation clinics for drug addicts and we don't have the money for it, we don't have money for textbooks in schools in some parts of this country. It's because that money is going to pay for the overhead costs of imperialism, to protect and maintain a U.S. force throughout the world, to protect that class that George Bush belongs to protect his friends of that class. And to protect that class, you have to protect that system that serves that class. And to protect that system, you have to protect that military, that global military establishment that protects that system. We also pay in terms of the export of our jobs. Our jobs go to Central America, Asia, Africa. And General Motors closes down plants and eliminates jobs. What GM doesn't tell you is that when they close plants down here, they're opening plants in Indonesia and Brazil and South Korea and those places. For 15 years, I've been hearing about General Motors closing plants, General Motors taking a beating, General Motors laying off workers, generals. That's it. What you don't know, yet last month, the Fortune 500 came out, and the biggest, richest industrial corporation in America is what? General Motors. General Motors is the biggest. And General Motors now says, we're not an American corporation. We're international. We don't belong to any one country. Of course they don't want to belong to any one country. They want to be above the laws of all countries. They're up there. But when their interests are at stake, then they do come, they get very socialistic. They come to the public treasury, to the public taxes, and they ask for our money to build up the public military forces to protect their private wealth. That's what imperialism is about. We also pay in the neglect of social needs in our country. We also pay in that the lives of our sons and daughters, our brothers and sisters are put at risk and killed. We have now in Iraq already lost 42 military personnel, plus one suicide, 43. And there hasn't been any war yet. The other sufferers of imperialism are the peoples of the third world, those who must work at subsistence wages when they're lucky enough to get a job, who suffer terrible neglected social needs. There are parts of Central America where whole chunks of the population have absolutely no access to a single hospital or health clinic or anything of the sort. They suffer political repression. They suffer environmental devastation. We always think of the environment as being devastated in industrial areas like LA or New York or in the industrialized world. But you should go to the third world. The land is in a state of shock. There are no environmental protections against the massive use of pesticides. There's no occupational safety laws, no minimum wage laws, none of those things. The result of all that, though, are profit rates. Rates of exploitation that are 200 and 300% higher than they are even in the United States or Western Europe. So that's what imperialism is about. Now, to justify that arrangement, for almost 80 years, the United States and other Western countries have used the Bolshevik menace. In the beginning, now they called it, later on they call it the Soviet menace. That is, we had to maintain this great military machine to meet the Soviet challenge. Now, I argued in The Sword and the Dollar, long before the dramatic changes in Eastern Europe, which is still going on, that if the communist countries were to disappear tomorrow, that we would still need a huge military establishment. I said, it's too bad reality isn't like an experiment where you can control for a certain variable and you can test your hypothesis. Well, sometimes reality is like an experiment. That particular variable suddenly is dissolving itself, and we are testing. And the test shows so far that indeed that's exactly what happens. That our leaders get up and they say, we have to be in Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Grenada, Indonesia, and so many other places. We had to be in those places. We had to overthrow those governments. We had to support dictators and death squads, or sometimes elected governments. You can get elections in a lot of these countries, but they are elections which exclude the working class. And you exclude the working class, as you do, for instance, good portions of the poor and working class in this country, not necessarily by disfranchising them, but by giving them nothing to vote for, by giving them two candidates who are both members of the oligarchy. We had to do all that stuff because of the Soviet menace. We had to do all that. Well, I argued that was being done not because of the Soviet menace, but others of us on the left, but because we had to make the world safe for multinational investments, for big banks and big oil companies that own so much of that world. and that you couldn't tell the American people who were out there doing all this to make the world safe for Chase Manhattan and General Motors, so you had to tell them we were making the world safe for our national security. But you couldn't convince them that a little Grenada or Panama or Nicaragua was a threat to our national security, so you said that, oh, the Nicaraguans were the puppets of the Cubans who were the puppets of Moscow. Now you have a situation where the global evil empire is just, the leader of the evil empire has just won the Nobel Peace Prize, and the empire itself is dissolving and cutting its troops dramatically, 15%. And if the global military machine were a response to Soviet aggression, why are U.S. leaders saying, we can't cut our defenses now? You heard George Bush the other day, he just a couple of months ago, said, we can't cut, that dynamic way he talks, he goes, just turns you on, you're like, oh, Georgie, hit me with it, oh. He said, we can't cut the muscle out of our defense posture. Admiral Trost, who's chief of naval operations, the highest ranking officer of the U.S. Navy in this country, said, the function of the U.S. Navy is not merely to defend us from the Soviet Union. We have many other functions. I said, oh, that's interesting. I always thought it was the Soviet menace. No, no. The Navy has to show the flag in different places. Now, that's an interesting phrase, show the flag. That's what we used to call imperialism, gunboat diplomacy, where you go bring your battleship into an area and you show the flag and you intimidate the people there and you let them know, we've got this power, and if you don't behave, we'll bombard your port and we'll do this and the other thing. And we have to also give support to U.S. forces in regional conflicts. Read Third World National Liberation Wars. So they're saying, we still need that global empire, that global military machine, because we have a global economic empire in which the multinational corporations invest and enrich themselves at great benefit to themselves, and sometimes at great cost to us. All the time at great cost to us. You can understand now why when Reagan went into the Persian Gulf with that fleet, to protect the oil supply coming out during the Iran-Iraq war, and people said, wait a minute, this whole operation is costing us $2 for every dollar's worth of oil we're taking out. That's a losing proposition. But Reagan kept doing it. Why? Because the $2 was being paid by you out of that little paycheck that you get. And the $1 went to the oil cartels. And people said, wait a minute, about 18% of that, or what was it, 12% of that oil comes here. The rest of it goes to France and Japan and Germany and other places. That's right, they're not protecting your oil supply. They're protecting, and they're not protecting Japan and France's oil supply. They're protecting the oil supply of the Seven Sisters, the giant oil companies. They're protecting Gulf and Exxon and Mobil and British Petroleum, and that's what they're doing. And they'll spend $2 of your money to protect $1 of their money. They'll spend $3, $4, $5 of your money. Money is no object when it's your money protecting my money. So that's what it's about. There's another reason why they have to keep this global military machine, and that's because it happens to be one of the greatest sources of domestic capital investment right here in America. Military spending is an essential part of this economy. It also is the single most profitable part. It is heavily subsidized. There are guaranteed cost overruns. There's non-competitive bidding for contracts. It represents a form of government spending that business can live with. You see, it's like any other private contract that business gets. They get a contract for, to build a building or to build tanks. That's profits for them. It's very different from government spending that goes into the non-profit public sector for human services and such. When you expand that sector, the more you expand that sector, the more you're saying, we could do much of this, we can carry on much of the business of living without someone having to make profits from it. But in military spending, there are very direct and immediate contract profits. And a military contract, by the way, is the best kind of profit. It's a contracted market. You see, if I'm making refrigerators, I have to worry about selling those refrigerators. But if I got this contract to make planes or tanks, it's already guaranteed for me. So it's really quite a deal. It doesn't cut into profits the way environmental controls do, or safety, health regulations, and all those other things that government might do to protect the quality of our lives. In fact, it increases profits. It also happens to be one of the greatest polluters around, the military. So those are the two reasons why, even if the Soviet Union disappears, and the Soviet Union cuts its military forces even more dramatically and withdraws from Eastern Europe as it is doing, we will still, our leaders will still argue that we need a military machine. Those are the two reasons, the military-industrial complex profits and the necessities of Third World imperialism. But without the Soviet menace, without that justification, our leaders have to cast around for new enemies. And we get a whole cast of enemies. As the existing communist governments transform themselves into right-wing capitalist governments, which is what Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Poland has done, and the left won fair elections in Romania and Bulgaria, but the right pressure is there too, and they will eventually be unseated, and I think you see the same thing happening in the various republics in the Soviet Union. As they convert into right-wing, retrograde, anti-Semitic, chauvinistic, ethnocentric, pro-Western imperialist governments, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Poland just voted with the United States to condemn human rights violations in Cuba. Czechoslovakia has never uttered a word since Havel has become president, has never uttered a word of condemnation of human rights in El Salvador or in Guatemala or in any of the other U.S. client states. Now, as you see that happening, who are going to be the new enemies to justify this global military machine that is rationally and definitely needed as a form of capital formation, capital investment, capital return, capital accumulation, and as an instrument of imperialism? Who is going to justify, what are you going to justify? You conjure up new enemies and you start talking about terrorists, international terrorist rings, narco-terrorists, and international drug trade. By the way, there is a real international drug trade, and it is a terrible thing, and it is doing terrible things to our communities. You talk about Saddam Hussein as being worse than Hitler. He's worse than Hitler. Isn't that a good one? Iraq fits into this picture very nicely. What happens in Iraq is a situation where the U.S. can establish a military presence in the Middle East, and in fact is now talking about a new order in the Middle East of military alliances that will be like a NATO force. The function of that will be to maintain stability in the Middle East. Stability is a code word for keeping things the way they are, to avoid social upheavals, to avoid challenges through existing class structures in the Arab worlds. So there'll be no more revolutionary movements as in South Yemen. There'll be no more revolutionary movements like the Polisario regime in the Western Sahara. There'll be no more Gaddafis or populist nationalists like Mossadegh and Gaddafi who nationalize our oil and use some of the profits for the well-being of their own people. We will keep those countries as they are. They will be client states with oppressive, privileged social orders where a few monarchist feudal families control those countries, but they leave them wide open to the U.S. oil cartels. And this Saddam Hussein invasion of Kuwait is a perfect opportunity for George Bush to go in and create this military buildup and to keep the place safe for the oil cartels and to maintain better opportunities for counterinsurgency should popular rebellions arise. And believe me, in countries like Saudi Arabia and a few others, you have very large, disgruntled, restive populations. You have a mass of people, Arabs, who see a very wealthy countries they live in where a few families live in utter wealth at their expense, and they see none of it coming down on them in many cases. There's another function for this invasion, and that is, by invasion I mean 200,000 U.S. forces going into Saudi Arabia for this military intervention, and that is to maintain popularity at home. Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist Paper number 6 that political leaders will very often start wars abroad or engage in confrontations abroad against adversaries in other countries so as to activate popularity at home. I'm doing a very elaborate study of that now, and it's amazing the cases. I've been looking at the instances of U.S. bellicose diplomacy in the 1890s. The same kind of things, a number of instances where U.S. diplomacy was utterly truculent, where there was no really question of national security or national interest involved. and yet getting involved, and at the same time putting a cap on the kinds of domestic grievances that were going on. And I could show you some quotes. I didn't bring it, it's another whole lecture, but quotes by political leaders saying, we can knock the pus out of this anarchistic, socialistic, populistic boil that's affecting our political surface by getting into a good war with Britain over Venezuela, 1895, Senator from Virginia, forget his name, saying things like that. It'll be great to get the people to rally around the flag. And the function of these foreign wars is to activate that national chauvinism, or if not necessarily to activate it, to blur out and mute the honest domestic grievances that people may have, make it harder for those things to be heard by waving the flag and saying, we're facing a crisis, we're in a confrontation. And so those bread and butter grievances are put aside. U.S. Consul General in Havana, Fitzhugh Lee, writing to President Cleveland in 1896, we ought to have a war with Spain. It would free the American people from their imaginary ills. That's almost a direct quote. I'm writing a book on this subject now. Fitzhugh Lee, former slave owner, former governor of Virginia, ex-Confederate general, nephew of Robert E. Lee, talks about the grievances that Americans were feeling in the 1890s, the massive strikes, the hunger, the malnutrition, the farmers' rebellions, the marches of the poor to Washington. Call those grievances imaginary ills. And a war with Spain would distract them from those imaginary ills, and it would certainly push those issues out of the way, as the newspapers would be filled with war news. Does it sound familiar to you? A way of fence-mending, of strengthening my party's fortunes. Richard Hofstadter, historian, writing 30 years ago that these confrontations were a method of strengthening the political fortunes of political leaders and men spending and extending the fortunes of their particular party, writing well before George Bush. And so with this invasion, George Bush has gotten the SNL things off the front pages. You know, he was taking a beating in July. The revelations were coming out one after the other after the other. Neil Bush was in it and so forth. And the momentum on that was something. His popularity had plunged 20 points. And it plunged again with the budget mess, where he came out and with an honesty that is utterly uncharacteristic of him said, no taxes for the wealthy, and kept saying that again and again. And now he's immediately conjuring up this other thing again in the week before elections, talking about, I'm sick of it. The same kind of things. You know, I sit in the National Archives all day, reading through these State Department reports and cables and all that, and I come out and look at the newspapers, and I almost have to laugh. It's a kind of a bitter, ironic laugh. The same kinds of rhetoric. We are reaching the end of our patience. The demands of humanity necessitate us acting. We can no longer stand idly by while these terrible atrocities go on, et cetera, et cetera. What you also do with things like the Iraq intervention is you conjure up again the image that there's a world of adversaries out there. And you can get Defense Secretary Cheney then saying, let's put all those military cuts that you Congress wanted to do, let's put them on hold. Our boys are out there on the firing line, on the front line. And while they're there facing this Hitler demonic maniac, Saddam Hussein, the worse than Hitler, worse than Genghis Khan, worse than anything that's ever existed anywhere ever in the whole world. While our boys are facing that monster, you can't deny them a single hand grenade or aircraft carrier. Can you, Congressman?
Well, I guess not. Especially if the naval base is in my district.
Well, that's called a community of interests. Right? So, the peace dividend that we were just talking about a couple of months ago, there's no more peace dividend. There's not going to be a peace dividend. They were talking about $50 billion peace dividend. What a big dividend, huh? That's what the Pentagon spends in about a month and a half. $50 billion dividend we were going to get. No more. Senator Nunn on McNeil Lair says, when he's asked, how much is this Iraq thing going to cost, this Middle East intervention? He said, it's going to cost $50 billion. I'm sitting there going, goodbye, peace dividend. $50 billion, he says, if there's no fighting. And so that's where this money's going. And they can say, well, we can forget about all your peace cuts and peace dividends and wanting to waste that money on things like clean air and clean air bills and whatever.
This is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Here's more from Michael Parenti's Imperialism, Drugs, and Social Control, the link between U.S. intervention and the CIA's use of drugs abroad and at home. It was recorded in Boulder, Colorado on November 4, 1990.
And so you have another thing you have at this time to maintain this image of a world of adversaries and to maintain the global military machine, and also to serve as an excuse for counterinsurgency, is the war on drugs. The war on drugs is mostly a phony war, I would argue. It's a cover for imperialism, and it's a cover for the CIA's own drug dealing. It's also a cover for the war against political dissidents in various countries. America's Watch report, October 31st, 1990. The one-year effort against drug traffickers actually has become a war against the political left in Colombia. The U.S. is giving funds to military and paramilitary groups that are being used to torture and kill dissidents. America Watch, actually Human Rights Watch, the parent organization of America Watch, made this report. These are the summary findings. The violence is mostly by the counterinsurgency death squad actions against the legal left, against student leaders, peasant co-op leaders, labor leaders, journalists, and others who are arguing for social change. This underscores the Colombian military's unwillingness to allow a left electoral challenge, a peaceful left challenge. Many big drug dealers in Colombia are now rich. They own land, they have legitimate investments, and so they now share the right-wing campaign and the right-wing rich, privileged class perspective against labor leaders, against critical journalists, against people who want social change, who want to give better wages to their campesinos who work on their latifundios and the such. Unfortunately, the Human Rights Watch person, by the way, who was giving this report on Pacifica Radio, went on to add to the fable, which often happens. He said, unfortunately, he said, U.S. policy is mistaken, and U.S. policy is an error. And George Bush, in his haste to fight the war on drugs, is giving money to the wrong people. And I'm saying, he isn't giving money to the wrong people. He's giving money to the people he wants to give money to. What makes you think these guys are sleepwalkers? What makes you think they don't know what they're doing? Just because you don't know what they're doing doesn't mean they don't know what they're doing. Take the case of Panama. Panama is a perfect example on the war on drugs. The argument we got was that we had to go into Panama to get Noriega. And of course, you remember George Bush creating the casus belli there too? A casus belli means a cause for war. It really, the way the US used it, it's a pretext for war. One of the arguments he gave was one of our soldiers, a lieutenant, was killed. No, it wasn't a lieutenant, it was an enlisted man, wasn't it? Well, what did he do? He drove a Jeep through a checkpoint right in front of the Panama military headquarters, a thing well lit, well designated. That was a provocation, you see. He thought he was going to get arrested and held and roughed up, but they opened fire and killed him, which was even better. Then a lieutenant and his wife were arrested by the Panamanian police because they were in a prohibited area. They had gone driven in also. And George Bush got up there and he said, I'm not going to stand idly by while these Noriega thugs brutally, verbally assaulted an American woman. This guy's a defender of American women. She was brutally, verbally assaulted in a brutal fashion, though. Probably called names and things and all that. Brutally. This is the man who opposes legal and safe abortions for women in this country. This is the man who just vetoed, the first president just vetoed the Civil Rights Act, which he called the quota system, which had no quotas in it, which had been rewritten and watered down in some 20 different places by his specifications, and still he vetoed it to play to the white backlash, convincing all sorts of people in this country that there's a quota system, that there are these women and minorities going around who want special treatment, who aren't qualified for these jobs. When that act was trying to get at something else, it wasn't favorable treatment, it was equal treatment. That's what the civil rights is about. It's not to give quotas, it's not to give affirmative action or advantage, it's to stop the same old rotten discrimination in hiring, promotion, training, evaluations, and job treatments. That's what the act was about. This is the guy who now comes around and pretends he's the defender of American women. What a hypocrite. That's all he is. A liar and a hypocrite. Now, So they went in to get Noriega. Well, you know, they're still there. There's a U.S. military occupation of Panama. It seems to have escaped the attention of the media that we already got Noriega. He's in a Miami jail. And what, in fact, the U.S. is doing, supposedly in this war against drugs, what the U.S. is doing in Panama is purging the whole government. It's had 1,000 people in jail, and that included dissident journalists, included Escaltiera Calvo, Mr. Calvo, who is a publisher of a newspaper that was giving too accurate and too vivid descriptions of the deaths to Panamanians of the U.S. military action and of the repression that was going on. He got arrested and thrown into jail. Journalists are in jail, intellectuals in jail. Panama City University has been purged of anybody who has a dissident or critical view of U.S. policy. And the government, elected by no one, is now headed by Mr. Endara and Vice President Arias and Ford. All three of these men have been connected to drug laundering banks in Miami. And they're up there. It wasn't a war against drugs. These guys are druggies themselves. They're the big pushers, the respectable pushers. And Dara also owned a whole chain of whorehouses in Panama City. You don't hear Tom Brokaw talking about that, do you? So drug dealing is a way of, it's an excuse for overthrowing governments. And the Noriega government was a populist nationalist government. That's what was wrong with it. It wasn't the drugs. It was that it was a populist nationalist government. The Panamanian Defense Force was a left force. They used to shake down the big banks and corporations in Panama and take money. It was like a Huey Long operation. Put a little in my pocket, a little for the boys. But they also would start these social programs for people, some of which were pretty good, including a Social Security program in Panama. You tell me, what Salvadoran has Social Security? What Guatemalan has Social Security? And that's why they went after them, because they were populist nationalists, because they were going that Gaddafi, Mossadegh, Sukarno route. They weren't communists at all, but they were just doing that sort of thing. Drug dealing is also by the way, official drug dealing, the massive, not the retail stuff, but the wholesale stuff that the CIA and the other intelligence operations do, is also a way of winning and bribing and keeping friends, the kind that kill and make the world safe for the multinationals. I remember when Ramon Rodriguez appeared before Senator Kerry's committee, and they said, "What are you doing now, Ramon Rodriguez?" He said, "I'm doing 20 years for drug laundering." I said, "Oh, how much did you handle a week?" He said, "I used to handle about $10 million in cash a week." Can you imagine the size of this guy's suitcases? "And I used to go in and out of these countries." And they said, "What countries besides Panama did you go to, if any?" He said, "Well, Senator," he said, "I went to Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Guatemala, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Dominican Republic, you name them all." And he said, "And who did you deal with there?" And he said, "Well, I dealt with the top executive leaders and, in many cases, top military leaders of all these countries. So if you want a war on drugs, why don't you go and catch the right-wing fascists who are doing all this stuff in these countries? They don't want a war on drugs. Those guys are on the drug payroll." Senator D'Amato said, you know, Senator D'Amato, the guy's got such a polish and poise. He says, "How did you get through customs with all that money?" And I'm sitting there, I'm saying, "Schmuck, get through customs." And and Ramon Rodriguez says, "Well, really, Senator, you know, when you have $10 million, you don't go through customs. They have, you know, helicopters and limousines for you and all that, and they have other special." He says, "Oh, yeah, oh, I see." Now, Ramon Rodriguez got caught. It's interesting. Part of the government has to carry out, because of the pressure of the public to do something, they have to actually carry out some of these actions, and they come into collision with other parts of the government. And they put Ramon Rodriguez in jail. Ramon Rodriguez is a close friend of Felix Rodriguez. I mean, he said it. I heard the man say it. Said it in English. "I'm a friend of Felix Rodriguez." And I know Felix Rodriguez is a close friend of George Bush's and Donald Gregg's, George Bush's familiar, who was there on time, who was in on all this Contra arms drug stuff. That operation was coming right out of the vice president's office when George Bush was vice president. And they used drugs to pay off their client state leaders. They used drugs to finance their counterinsurgency wars when Congress cut back, as was true of the Contras. In the Iran-Contra hearings, a congressperson, Les Aspin, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, came forward and he said, "The monies mentioned so far, the $10 million in the Swiss bank, the $10 million here and all that, do not explain the costs of the Contras. There's at least another 50 or 60 million that would have been needed to maintain that force. Where did that other money come from? There were those of us who knew where the rest of that money came from, but the committee said nothing. They all sat there going, Don't know. Hear no evil, see no evil, whatever else. The committee did not pursue that matter. In 1987, the Reagan-Bush administration asked Texas billionaire Ross Perot. Now, Ross Perot is a nice little old earthy reactionary Texas millionaire. But, you know, he's got some honest strains in him. He gets up sometimes, he says things like, this business on Wall Street, all these mergers and all these corporate raiders, that's rotten stuff. I don't like it. It's not productive capital. He says things like, all this football mania is terrible for our education in our state, and it hurts the athletes too. So he's got, the trouble with Ross Perot as a right winger, he doesn't really qualify because he's got these strains of truth running through him every so often. So they got Texas billionaire Ross Perot to investigate the question of missing Vietnamese prisoners of war. You see, there are over 2,000 U.S. soldiers who are still missing. And they've been playing upon the feelings and sentiments of people by arguing that these people are, some maybe still alive, or lots of them maybe still alive. But they've been playing on this, trying to account for these 2,000 missing bodies, as if the Vietnamese had an interest in keeping these guys, when the Vietnamese interest, of course, is in trying to establish normal trade, aid, and political and diplomatic relations with the U.S. But they asked Perot to go out and look for the missing Vietnamese. Well, when George Bush, who was vice president then, asked Ross Perot how the investigation was going, Perot replied, quote, "Well, George, I go in looking for prisoners, but I spend all my time discovering the government has been moving drugs around the world and is involved in illegal arms deals. I can't get at the prisoners because of the corruption among our own covert people." I'm quoting the San Francisco Examiner, October 25, 1990. Carried that quote in big bold type over Warren Hinkle. Now, Perot was then dropped like a hot potato by the Reagan administration. He said, this guy doesn't realize what the name of the game is, they're saying. Once they realized that he was taking his assignment too seriously and he was uttering truthful statements, that they had to get rid of him, dropped him. In April 1988, a former intelligence aide to Noriega, Jose Blandon, told the Curry Committee that arms were smuggled to the Nicaraguan Contras, while cocaine was smuggled from Colombia to the U.S. via Panama. It's a two-way thing. He also noted that the Costa Rican airstrips used for arms deliveries to the Contras also carried narcotic shipments to the U.S. Costa Rica has just made charges against John Hull and asking him to be extradited. I read a piece in the New York Times about last May, an article in the New York Times about John Hull and Costa Rican Congress saying, this guy has been involved, we want him for drug smuggling, arms smuggling, drug smuggling, and murder. And they also named complicit with him. Do you know who they named? You don't know who they named because it was in the New York Times on page 25 and it was in about the 30th paragraph. Right there, in the 30th paragraph, well, you didn't see it. They also named Colonel North and Rob Owen. Rob Owen, who at that time was legislative assistant to Senator Dan Quayle of Indiana, who then became George Bush's vice presidential candidate. And there it was, right there, in the 30th paragraph in the New York Times. Just three lines, just mentioned as a matter of fact, said they were complicit and they had been working with Hull. I said, isn't that interesting? Imagine if that was Jesse Jackson and the Sandinistas. You think it'd be back to just two lines there? Drugs are also very useful as an instrument of social control. Letting the stuff pour into the United States is profitable for CIA operatives and supportive of their policy abroad, but it also increases consumption among troubled and troublesome social and ethnic elements in the United States, among the poor Latino communities especially, and African American communities. Now, it's not just that there's such a demand in those communities for supply. You know, 30 years ago, those communities were just as poor as they are now. And they weren't consuming drugs at that level. They had all the social pathology they have now, and they weren't consuming drugs at that level because the drugs weren't pouring in. They weren't pouring in at such accessible prices the way they are now. So it's not only that demand creates a supply, but that supply creates a demand. The trick to any consumption, the first condition for any form of consumption is availability and accessibility. You have to get that product there before those publics and get it in plentiful supplies and make it and have it all around. And if you want to hear, if you want to hear how people feel about legalization of drugs, forget Boulder, Colorado. Go to Harlem. See Black Men Against Crack. Go talk to them. Go to Southeast Washington, D.C., where I live. No, we're not talking about legalizing marijuana. If you want to legalize marijuana, then use the English language and say marijuana. Don't say drugs. Because drugs to other people in this country means crack and ice and PCBs and heroin. It means the destruction of their communities. And it means they keep their kids locked up in the house after school, don't even let them out, because there's so much of the drugs around. It's all around, and the stuff is coming in. And the U.S. government is doing nothing. They're arresting the ponies. They're not going after the big guys. And that is a very functional thing, because those communities are totally immobilized by the drug plague. Instead of fighting and mobilizing against the Reagan cuts, they've been fighting for their lives against the drug infestation. Availability is the first condition, and if you legalize it, if you legalize availability, then if you legalize drugs, you make it all the more available and all the more accessible. Supply has a way of creating demand. And what that does is you now have a whole generation of Latino men who are not joining the Young Lords, who are not joining protest groups, revolutionary groups as they did in the 60s. You got a whole generation of Black men who are not joining the Black Panthers or some other groups like that. They're not causing trouble. They're too busy shooting each other up with guns and shooting themselves up with needles to be doing that. It's a very functional form of social control. When the British introduced great quantities of opium into China in the middle of the last century, it was not in response to some popular demand on the part of the Chinese. They didn't just say, "We want to become dope heads. You got any on you?" For the British, it was a devilishly convenient way of taking a product grown in one colony in India and Egypt and places like that and selling it in China to keep a vast population quiescent and doped up. You know, when I was a kid, we used to see those old Fu Manchu movies with all the racial stereotypes and all that, and used to always see the opium den. And I associate the opium den as a Chinese institution. It's not indigenous to China. The Chinese never knew about opium dens. That was created by the British colonialists. In one of the most ragged, wretched, sorry pages of British imperialism's history, and there's a lot of dirty, blood-drenched pages in British imperialist history. Well, you know what happened? The opium wars occurred. The Chinese took up arms to try to defend their communities. The same kind of desperate situation that communities in the inner cities facing today. Somehow they knew that just saying no wasn't going to do it. Somehow they knew that legalization wasn't enough. The British had indeed legalized it. The British legally distributed it everywhere, every place. Supply creating the demand. And the big suppliers were bringing in the stuff. And the British pushers were creating a demand. Well, supply is increasing at home and doing the same thing here. This explains why the very presidents, Bush and Reagan, who supposedly were dedicated to fighting a war on drugs, have done some very strange things with the drug budget. Ronald Reagan cut the DEA budget substantially. He caused the dismissal of 434 DEA employees, including 211 agents. He cut the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is now in on the smuggling, it seems, or at least some elements are in, those who were clumsy enough to get caught. The U.S. Attorney's staff was cut by Ronald Reagan, drastically bringing a shortage of lawyers, causing the Justice Department to drop 60% of its drug and crime cases. This is under Ronald Reagan, who was supposedly, go ahead, I saw you go, who was supposedly... who's supposedly fighting a war on drugs. You know how he was fighting a war on drugs, the way he fought everything else, with a few cheap PR slogans. We're getting Nancy out there and saying, "You don't really need drugs," she's saying, you see. When Bush came into office, he stepped into the presidency after a successful career as arms runner and drug pusher from the vice president's office. And not surprisingly, he hasn't done anything. He has restored none of the Reagan cuts, and he's initiated some of his own. He cut the Texas Border Patrol, even though at a time when it was discovered that the Mexican border was the greatest inflow of drugs coming in. He has sent money to Colombia and Peru, but as I pointed out earlier, it's not being used for drug enforcement, but for the militaries in those countries. By the way, this makes it rather intriguing as to why right-wing columnists like William Buckley write columns saying that trying to fight drugs and drug infestation in America is a hopeless situation and you really can't and you ought to leave it alone. Arguing two arguments. One is that the drug problem isn't that serious, and two is that you really can't stop it because it's so big. It's interesting, and I'm saying, isn't this funny? Some of these conservatives had taken such a lackadaisical attitude about what's happening to inner city communities. These are the same guys who on other days of the week are ranting about the destruction of American values and the fabric of our society and community and family and all that, but they seem to take a rather languid view when these drugs come pouring in such abundance into the inner city. And I guess if I was a right-winger, that's the way I'd want it, too. I'd want them shooting themselves up rather than organizing in social challenges against the oppressions that their communities face. So I guess what I'm saying is that narcotics are an important instrument of repression and social control. Everybody, I know a number of people here have been focusing on how the police would be used, or the war against drugs would be used as an instrument of oppression against our rights. Let me point out that narcotics themselves are being used as instruments to destroy the rights of people. It's not a right to choose. You can't look at the right to choose in a social vacuum. You have to look at rights to choose within the social context and realities they're facing. And that's no real choice that these guys are being given. I mean, this is an issue, of course, that could somehow backfire. We're not to put ourselves against drug enforcement. I would argue we should advocate real enforcement because it's victimizing people in a real and horrible way. In any case, my view is that we should be for the well-being, peace, health, and safety of our communities. We are for the end of imperialist interventionism and adventurism and global power mongering of the kind we see in Central America and now in the Middle East. We should be for drastic cuts in the military establishment and the intelligence community. The intelligence community still is getting $34 billion a year to wreak misery, violence, and oppression around the world. And so it goes. George Santayana once said that those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. That quote is so repeated, so often quoted reverentially and all that, I don't believe it. At least I don't believe it in regard to our leaders and such. I don't believe they repeat these patterns because they don't read history, but because they know that history all too well. They know how these things happen. They develop these methods through trial and error. They develop new methods, too, with new situations, and they keep doing the things they do. If empires resemble each other in their lies and their hypocrisy and their violence and their crimes and their homicidal oppressions, if they resemble each other, it's not because the leaders ignored the history and just foolishly repeated it, the way that guy from America Watch was saying George Bush was doing with the funds to Colombia. It's because those leaders are doing the same things. They are facing the same set of social interests, roughly the same kinds of class conflicts, and they're doing those same kinds of things. And we've got to know that, and we've got to fight it in every way we can. The struggle against the imperialist drug dealers is an important part of the struggle for peace and democracy. And those are the two things we want, peace and democracy. But as much as we want peace, we're not afraid of struggle. Thank you.
That was Michael Parenti discussing imperialism, drugs, and social control, the link between U.S. intervention and the CIA's use of drugs abroad and at home. It was recorded in Boulder, Colorado on November 4, 1990. The full version is at the Michael Parenti Archive, michael-parenti.org, which also includes summaries of his many books, video of his many talks, quotations, and more. The Michael Parenti Library, devoted exclusively to his talks, is also available on the YouTube. They will no doubt be read and listened to for many years to come. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by me, Ann Garrison, and the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with editing by Polina Vasilia. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.